Welcome to Ancient Philosophy. This is a course you're going to enjoy, despite the fact that you may have fears about it and reservations. I think you're going to enjoy it anyway. Philosophy is a fascinating subject, and we are going to start right at its beginnings, see the very first theories ever proposed, and then we're going to end with some of the most influential theories ever proposed. Theories of Plato and Aristotle. They're still influential today. They carry enormous weight in the many fields that today, and that may come as a surprise to you, but we've not rid ourselves of their influence by any means. And I say that with grudging admiration, not with approval. I don't agree with them. I'm going to say that their theories are false. In fact, I'm going to argue that they are theories no Christian should hold. Nevertheless, many do, and it's important for us to get clear about what they are. So let's start with philosophy itself, clarify that term. What do we mean when we say that we're going to study philosophy? Well, in a university catalog or in these series of lectures, it means a certain kind of theory. It doesn't just mean a loosey-goosey policy that someone may have. I've seen this in stores. I've gone and seen our philosophy is that our customers are always right, something like that. That just means a policy adopted, an attitude adopted. It's much more specific than that when you come to study the field of philosophy. It's a certain kind of theory. So that's the first thing we want to get down. It's a theory. So what do we mean then when we say that it's a theory? Well, a theory is a certain kind of guess. A guess. An educated guess, but nevertheless, it's a guess. When we want to explain something, and we can't discover what the answer is, we often make a guess about what the answer is. Now, sometimes this happens in a very non-technical sort of setting. Think about a bunch of people go to work one morning and then they have several encounters with their boss, and afterward they're at the water cooler and they say, "Boy, is he a grouch today. What do you think's eating him?" And one of them says, "Well, look out the window. Did you see his new car? It's all smashed into the back. I'll bet he's upset over that." That's a theory. That's a guess as to why the boss is upset. Could be dead wrong. Could be his car smashed in. That's not what he's upset about at all. On the other hand, it might be that that is the reason. But that's a theory. When you make a guess to explain something, we've got a theory going. There's another term that's used, hypothesis. Now, a lot of people use these two terms interchangeably, and others are a little more precise about it. They use theory to mean any number of hypotheses along with the reasons for them. So that's, in that case, theory would have a broader meaning. But you have to be prepared that as you in literature and stuff that you read, some people just go back and forth between using them interchangeably. They both have to do with making guesses to explain. And unlike the guess that it's the boss's car being smashed in that made him such a grump today, the philosophical theories are more abstract. They deal with a specific side of reality, and they abstract from that. So let me give you an example of what I mean by an abstraction. Let's take a super simple example. It's a case in which I have red paint, and I have blue paint, and I mix them together, and the paint turns, I mix them together, and then I notice that the paint turns purple. Noticing that just concentrating on the color of the paint is abstracting that feature of the paint. I'm not concerned then with its viscosity or whether it's expensive or cheap or anything else, but its color. So that's an abstraction. So I single out the redness of the one pot of paint, and I single out the blueness of the other. I mix them together, and then I single out that the resulting paint turns purple. So I'm dealing with abstractions from reality, not the full reality of the paints in the pot and being mixed. And I want to know why it turns purple. Why doesn't it turn green or brown, solid back, black, or remain streaked? There's questions I can ask, and the answers are not obvious. It's not obvious why the paint turns purple rather than some other color. So I'm asking myself then, what other factors are there which, if I knew what they were, would lead to the conclusion that the paint turns purple? What other factors are involved? 4, 5, 6, 7, what would they be? And that's where we insert guesses and come up with a theory as to why red and blue, when mixed together, makes paint turn purple. Suppose my first guess is paint is made of little tiny particles called molecules. Not a very original guess on my part, is it? But that's what I'm guessing. Paint turns is made up of molecules. The molecules bond together in shapes. And so my additional theory here, my additional guess is that the paint that I see as red because it's shaped a certain way to reflect the red wavelength of light. Then I have the theory, another guess, that the paint that I see as blue reflects the blue wavelength of light. It is a different shape from the one that reflects red. And then I mix them together. And now when I mix them together, I get a new shape. And the new shape reflects purple wavelength of light. In that case, I now have a theory. I have several hypotheses that there are molecules, they have shapes, they bond together to form new shapes. The different shapes reflect different wavelengths of light, which is why I see different colors when I mix the paints together. And altogether, this is a theory about the paint color change. It's a super simple example. Of course, I could make another theory as well, you know. We could put down such things as I have red paint, blue paint, I mix the paint, and the paint turns purple. And my guesses might go like this. Inside paint, there are invisible paint pixies. Paint pixies of different colors hate each other. Because of that, they spit purple at each other. So the paint turns purple. That's also a theory. Not a very good one, but it's a theory. And it's a very interesting question why one of those theories is good and the other isn't. But this is not philosophy of science, so we're not going to go into that. But I am going to say that one of the things that makes the proposals of a theory good is that it can be checked on, it can be argued for, We can test it. We can try it out. And that the theory makes predictions which we can test. So suppose we have this theory about the shapes of the molecules and how they bond, and I figure out that given those shapes, if I were to mix two other colors, I'd get a third shape and yet another color, and it would predict that. We could test for it. There's no way to test what the pixies are going to do. Notice that it won't do to answer here, but you can't see paint pixies because you can't see molecules either, not with the naked eye. These are both theories. They're both explanatory guesses, and they're made to explain something we can't discover the truth of, but want to know about anyway. Now, in setting this up, I have set it up so that it looks like a logical argument. This is the way a logical argument is set up. Premise 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then we get a conclusion. Therefore, the paint turns purple. This is called a deductive form of explanation. It follows the format of a logical argument. And some people have been concerned about it because they've said, but not all arguments are deductive in this way. What we sometimes get is something that looks more like this. Premise one, most corporate lawyers are conservatives. Two, Miriam is a corporate lawyer. And what we get is Miriam is probably a conservative. So people have wanted to say, this isn't deductive in form. We don't get a certainty for the conclusion. What we get is a probability. And that needs to be put down then or recognized as a distinct form of explaining. I think we need to take this seriously, but it doesn't need to be a distinct form. And that's because the overall form of the argument is still that of a deduction. In other words, the conclusion is probable, but it's deductively certain that the conclusion is probable. So that the overall form of this is still deductive. In the literature, it's called deductive nomological. That means it's a deductive form and it uses laws. And that's what we get when we get when we construct a theory. We get a deductive nomological explanation of something. Fancy terms for simple ideas, right? You're not put off by the terms, I'm sure. Now, there are some misunderstandings about theories that we ought to clear up. And one of them is an important, very important. That it goes like this. In science, or maybe in philosophy too, we propose hypotheses we test the hypotheses and therefore prove the hypotheses are true. I'm sure that you've heard this idea. We construct a theory, a bunch of hypotheses. We run tests. The tests turn out the way we had hoped. Now we've proven the theory is true. As a matter of fact, that's not the way it works. And it's more complicated than that, and we need to understand why. And the reason is that no finite number of tests are going to prove that that theory, those hypotheses, are in fact true. And to explain this, I need to explain to you a point in logic, simple point. Let's do this. This is a simple, we have a simple logical rule, and it is, this says, if P is true, Q is true. P is true, I'm sorry. P is true, so Q is true. Here's another one. If P is true, Q is true. Q is not true, so P is not true. Those are both logical rules. But here is one that is not. It goes like this. If P is true, then Q is. Q is true, therefore P is. That is not. Let's see why. Take this first one, this one up here on the left upper. Suppose this says, if it rains, the sidewalk gets wet. It rained, so the sidewalk got wet. The next one says, if it rains, the sidewalk will get wet. Sidewalk didn't get wet, it didn't rain. But this third one, which I'm saying is not a real argument form, it's not valid, goes like this. If it rains, the sidewalk will be wet. Sidewalk's wet, so it must have rained. But you and I know better than that, right? There are lots of other things could have wet the sidewalk. The garden hose, the lawn sprinkler, a flood. That last one, look at it again, that last one is not a valid argument form. Now take a look at what the person who says that experiments prove a theory is true, take a look at the form of his argument. It goes like this. If the theory is true, then the experiment will turn out. The experiment succeeds. The experiment succeeds. Therefore, the theory is true. That's exactly the form that we found was not a genuine logical rule. It goes, if the theory is true, look at it, if the theory is true, the experiment turned out, therefore the theory is true. Right? In other words, that's not a valid way to argue at all. It doesn't follow. What the truth of the matter is the more experiments we perform that turn out successfully, the more confident we feel about the theory, but no finite number of them is ever able to show that the theory is true beyond all doubt. So experiment is important, it plays a key role, but it can't establish a theory beyond all doubt in the way that the popular idea of science ascribes to it. It just doesn't work that way. So what are the theories about that philosophy cooks up? This is the part that bothers some people, but other people find it the most delightful. I think the easiest way to explain this is to say that we have a lot of different disciplines, branches of knowledge, fields of study. There is mathematics, We study space with geometry. We study physics, the cause and effect forces of matter and energy. We study biology of the life processes of plants and animals. We study psychology, which has to do with perception and feeling. There is the field of logic that has to do with reasoning. We were just now looking at a couple of logical forms. We saw some valid arguments and one that's a fallacy, and one that's to be avoided, not used. We find that there are still other areas. For example, there's linguistics and economics and ethics. And I won't go on, there are many more, and you can name them for yourself. If we have all of these different disciplines and they all have a field of their own and they're all working away at explaining what's going on in their field, then what's left for philosophy to do? That's the question. It's a good question, right? I think it is. What's left for philosophy? Well, often I have this list on a blackboard for a class. I ask them to contribute to it. We get a much longer list. I haven't got the room to put more things down, but you got a pretty big list there. And they stare at it for a while, and usually, though, somebody comes up with something insightful. Some student says, could it be that philosophy is about how all of them hang together? How they all relate to each other? And which case I say, you get the gold star today. Exactly right. Exactly. These are all different sides to reality, different facets. But philosophy wants to know something general to them all. It wants to know, if these are all facets of reality, what is the reality they are all facets of? What is it that they all have in common? What are they all different sides of? And that brings us to the first thing that philosophy is a theory of. It's a theory of reality. And by that, I mean a theory of the nature of reality, right? The different disciplines are studying now the mathematical side of reality, its physical side, its ethical side, its logical side, and so on. But what is the reality? What's the nature of the reality that has all those different sides? That's the first kind of theory that philosophy is about. And the proper name for this is ontology. Not a word you're likely to have seen anywhere else, but that's what it's about. It's about ontology. And it also has a nickname. And the nickname is metaphysics. Now, don't be put off by that. It's good. So a lot of people, it sounds very mysterious or something. Actually, it's rather simple. After Aristotle died, his students collected their class notes and put them together. That's what we have of Aristotle's writings. We have collections of student class notes. In Plato's case, all of his class lecture notes were lost. All we have are the published popular works that he did. We don't have any of Aristotle's published popular works, only the class notes. And the students who put together these class notes first did his work on physics. Aristotle was a scientist as well as a philosopher. He did physics, he did biology, he wrote about astronomy. So they put together all the class notes about physics, all his lectures. They came to the next set of class notes. They were about his theory of reality. The work didn't have a title, and they weren't sure what to call it. So they called it the book that comes after the physics. That's what metaphysics means. Meta is the Greek word for after. After the physics. That's all. Nothing mysterious. Just here's the book on physics, here's the book that comes after it. But then because they called it the metaphysics, the book that comes after the physics, that became a word that meant whatever went on in Aristotle's work, which was the theory of reality. So it gets the nickname metaphysics. Now, there's a second kind of theory, though, that deals with how all the different disciplines hang together. And that is a theory of knowledge. It's not only that there are different sides to reality, and we want to know the nature of the reality they're all sides of. There are different sides of knowledge. There are different kinds. There's mathematical knowledge. There's physical knowledge. There's social knowledge, ethical, aesthetic, economic. Knowledge has as many branches as reality. So once again, the philosophical theory wants to know, but what is the nature of knowledge that is common to them all? What are they all different sides of? And under that, it wants to know some additional things. First, it wants to know, when do we have certainty? We all know that there are things that we believe that are not certain, and there are things that we believe we think are certain. So, for example, I may believe that this afternoon there will be a rainstorm. I may have some good reasons for thinking that might be true, but we all know I can't be sure of it. Even if the weather forecast is for rain, that won't give me certainty that it's going to rain, just a high probability. I might think that I'm pretty tired today, so I'm going to go to bed early tonight. I think by 10 o'clock I'll be in slumberland. Doesn't mean I can be certain of it. I don't know what's going to happen between now and then. On the other hand, there are other things that do seem to us completely certain. For example, that 1 and 1 make 2 in the natural number series. We also think we're certain about those logical rules I just showed you a moment ago. That if it rains, the sidewalk gets wet. If that's true and it rained, then the sidewalk will get wet. How do we tell the difference between what we can be certain of and what we can't? That's epistemology also. If we could uncover the nature of knowledge, its core nature, what all different kinds of knowledge, what it is that all the different kinds of knowledge have in common, then maybe we can answer when we have certainty. There's another question that comes up in epistemology. What is truth? What do we mean when we say that something is true? And how do we know it? That's what philosophy is about, folks. It's about two kinds of theories, a theory of reality and a theory of knowledge. In each case, what is desired is the essential nature of reality and knowledge. And it's in order to answer other questions. In particular, when we get a theory of knowledge and theory of reality, we then have a perspective on how all those different disciplines, all the specific sciences, relate to one another. And it gives us a very different perspective on all of that. This is what philosophy is about. This is what we are going to study. And we're going to look at how philosophy first arose, what theories people made, how they tried to argue for them, and then what results came about because of the way they construed their theories, how they disagreed with one another. I think you'll find it's interesting stuff. It may not be something you always dreamed about studying, but once you get into it, you'll find that it's pretty fascinating. Even from the very beginning, for example, there were philosophers who thought that the reality, the world that we live in, the central nature of that world was to be physical. And it was these ancient philosophers that came up with the idea that there are little tiny things so small that they can't be divided. And how they're put together makes up everything in the world. Their combination makes up everything. And they call those little things atoms. That was 500 BC. That was a long time ago. They did that when there was no way to confirm that theory. But they took it that the atoms were purely physical. And so everything else is purely physical. That's a theory that's still with us. Highly controversial. One I think is totally false. But then we got other theories, even way back when, that took it that the reality that we live in is purely not physical. The Pythagoreans. Now, I know you know about Pythagoras. You remember you studied the Pythagorean theorem in geometry, right? About the right triangle and the sum of the square of the sides is equal to the square of the hypotenuse and all that stuff. The Pythagoreans were a commune that did math. And they held, are you ready for this? Everything is not made of atoms, everything is made of numbers. Now, numbers aren't physical objects. They're abstract quantities. So Aristotle even makes a comment in one place that the Pythagoreans have the weirdest theory of reality because they think that the physical world we live in is made out of non-physical things, numbers. You put enough numbers together, you get a rock, or a tree, or a horse, or a planet. Does sound pretty weird, doesn't it? But that's what the Pythagoreans believed. So even from the very beginning, there were very sharp controversies about what the nature of reality was. The very first theories were about nature of reality. They were not about the nature of knowledge. Knowledge came up later for these ancients. And they tried to figure out how we knew what we knew and how perception worked and how logical conception works, and they thought about that stuff, but it's not until the later ones, the more recent ones. I mean, by the time you get to people such as Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, that they raise the question about the knowledge. And even then, they have a much harder time with it than they do theory of reality. So here's what we're in for. We're going to look at theories of reality. We're going to look at theories of knowledge. And we're going to see the very first ones ever proposed and the reasons given for them. Now, when I say that these are the first ones proposed, you may be a little puzzled to say, well, how do people explain things prior to that? And there's a clear answer to that. Before they invented theories, people explained the world around them. They explained their own lives, the stages of human life and so on. And human destiny were all expressed in myths. And a myth is not a hypothesis. It's not a guess as to how things really work. It's a way of trying to explain the world and our lives in terms we can understand, because it makes all the forces of nature out to be like other people interacting. And a myth is simply proposed. You don't argue with a myth. You don't say, no, the reasons don't confirm the myth or something like that. You don't try to give evidence in favor of a myth. You do with a theory. So a myth might be that the reason that we get night and day is that there's love and hate are two forces in the universe, and they strive with one another. And out of their fight comes day and night. Day and night, day and night. And then because of that succession of forces, there are yet others that affect humans and so on. It could go on and on. But it's not something that you would produce experiments to prove, what it is. It's just a story that helps us to understand our world and ourselves. So it's very different from proposing a guess that you then try to show evidence and reasons for thinking is true. The truth of the myth is how it illuminates our lives for us. It works or it doesn't. If it doesn't, it fades away. If it succeeds in helping people, they preserve it and they retell it and retell it and retell it. And that's what had been the case in the ancient world. And now we come to a point in that history where theories arise instead. And the theories are proposed as specific guesses. And reasons are given for them. So let's shift a bit to that. And let me tell you about the very first person to do this. First person we know of. If somebody else did it before this guy, we haven't discovered it yet. But the very first person to come up with a theory was a man named Thales. He is an ancient Greek, and he was considered a very wise man. In fact, the intellectual center of the ancient world was Egypt, where a lot of mathematics had been discovered, and the Egyptians had worked out a lot of things in astronomy and ways of calculating, and it was famous all over the world. Thales visited Egypt and made a terrific impression. First of all, the Egyptians explained to him that all of their economy and their life there depended on the Nile River overflowing and irrigating their crops. And they said they never knew when the Nile was going to overflow. They had no idea. They knew that it happened at a certain season of the year, but nobody could ever predict any closer than, well, it'll be sometime in the spring. They explained that to Thales. And how important it would be if they could get a more precise idea of when that was going to take place. And let me just real roughly draw here. This is the Egyptian coast, and this is the Mediterranean Ocean, and the Nile comes down here, and here's the Nile Delta, and the river comes off like that. Well, Thales came up with a theory. Instead of making a myth about the Mother Nile supplying all of our needs and all that, because he said, I'll tell you what I think. I think it has to do with wind shift. When the wind shifts and comes from the north, it blows against the mouth of the delta, the Nile Delta, and it backs the water up so that then it begins to overflow and irrigate your crops. So if you want to know when this is going to take place, it's when the wind shifts to the north. When you see that, then you know that within a few days, the Nile's going to start to back up and overflow. Well, the Egyptians thought this was the most amazing thing they'd ever heard. This seer, this sage, this wise man comes to us and tells us something we've lived with for centuries and centuries and centuries and never figured out how it worked. He did a number of other things like that as well, and he was celebrated as a great wise visitor. Now, what he's doing is explaining what's happening with the river in terms of the properties of the river and of the air, of the wind, and of the sea. And so he's not resorting to mythical figures. It's the characteristics of the stuff involved and how that might be arranged and how it might be working. And that's what characterizes theory. And very different from myth. Once theories were accepted in this way, they rapidly replaced myths. People were no longer happy with just getting a myth of, the forces of the universe relate like love and hate or night and day, or you strive this way and that. No. They They then wanted theories big time, and theories have replaced myths thoroughly all over the world and in every field whatsoever. Now, I'm going to end a little early today in order to give you time to do extra reading. What I want you to be sure to do with respect to these lectures is do the reading, look at the lecture, go back and do the reading again. You'll find that the second reading is going to be a lot clearer than the first. And two readings will set you in good shape for any of the exams or quizzes. So take this time, take this extra time, do the reading, and when we come back, we'll start to look at some of the earliest of the theories. See you then.